It's great to be with you. I'm a bit of an interloper as someone from the humanities, but I've been to two previous ASA gatherings. Randy and I were talking, and he informed me that it was 2001. I couldn't remember the year, but I remember the place. It was July, and it was Kansas. Manhattan, Kansas, as I recall, a Kansas State University gathering. And then in 2004, at Trinity Western University in beautiful British Columbia, I ran an all-day symposium based upon a summer before research symposium with a number of faculty at Calvin College. So it's great to be back. I lived in Chicago for 7 years, my wife and I and two of my three kids, two of whom were born here, so it's good to be back in or around the Windy City. The title of my talk is listed on the screen, One Example of Science, Faith, Synergy, the topic of this year's ASA gathering. How we can glorify God and serve humanity by caring for the earth. Let me start with the story. The up-and-coming scholar at age 29 had just made a career move to a new city. He was a professor in the liberal arts, and his career was blossoming. Though a teacher in the humanities, our young scholar was well-read in many academic disciplines, including the natural sciences. He was especially impressed by the scientific theories that correctly predicted certain natural phenomena, such as the eclipses of the sun and the moon. Furthermore, the confirmation of scientific theory by empirical observations was to him an important indication of religious truth. For almost a decade, our man had been an adherent of one of the popular religions of his day, but he had numerous questions about his faith and thus was keen to meet someone who could answer his queries. In his new location, he would have more opportunities to find such a person. Indeed, friends in the faith had told him that such a gentleman was living nearby and that this religious sage would answer all of his questions and resolve all the obstacles keeping him from becoming a more committed member of this religious group. So powerful was his need to address his intellectual questions that, in his own words, he, quote, waited with intense yearning for the chance to talk with this learned leader of his religion. The day came with great expectations, but our friend was greatly disappointed. The much ballyhooed expert spoke with pleasant words. His elocution was excellent, but the substance of what he had to say was lacking. He was handsome and eloquent, but he was not the expert on natural science that he was advertised to be. In the exchange of question and answer after his talk, it turned out that this religious leader had read some important books, but was woefully ignorant of much of the most recent research, especially in natural science. Most importantly, this person was unable to adequately reconcile certain passages from his religion's sacred texts about the sun and the moon and the stars with the truths of modern astronomy. In our friend's own words, and I quote again, I wanted him to tell me, after comparing the mathematical calculations which I had read in other books, whether the story contained in the sacred books was correct, or at least whether it had an equal chance of being so. I now did not think him clever enough to explain the matter. End quote. As a result of this encounter, our young scholar abandoned his religion and went in search of something more intellectually coherent and spiritually fulfilling. You may be wondering who this young scholar is. I hope you're wondering who this young scholar is. Any guesses? Nice and loud. Charles Darwin. Good guess, but that's not correct. Augustine. Who said Augustine? Right there. Extra credit bonus points to the young woman in the second row. If you guessed Augustine of North Africa, you are right. The year is 383 AD, And the person who would later become arguably the most influential theologian in the Western Church is an adherent of Manichaeism, a popular religion in the ancient Roman world. But because of the inability of anyone in that religious group to explain certain questions of science and faith, Augustine found it impossible to remain a Manichaean. Eventually, Augustine becomes a Christian, in large part, if you read his famous book, Confessions, the majority of which is an autobiography, in large part because he later learns through the sermons of Ambrose, the Christian bishop of Milan, he learns a different way of reading the Bible, especially the Old Testament, and thus is finally able to reconcile what he knows about science and astronomy in particular, and his now new faith. The Christian faith for Augustine is attractive precisely because it comports well with the science of his day. I begin with this story to make this point. How we Christians deal with scientific knowledge and its relation to our faith is absolutely crucial. This is something that you all, I'm sure, already know. But it's crucial in all kinds of ways. To quote Francis Collins and Carl Giberson on pages 17 and 18 of their new book, The Language of Science and Faith, University Press, 2011. Many Christians fear science because some loud atheists have argued that scientific explanations have replaced belief in God as creator. Scientific theories are proposed for the origin of the stars and planets or the diversity of life or the physical universe. And these explanations are said to challenge the idea that God created these things. This is simply not true, period. On the other hand, a little later, same page, some Christians advance the related argument that belief in God rules out various well-established scientific claims. They argue with the same passion as the atheists that scientific explanations for origins compete with the belief that God is the creator, and we must therefore choose one or the other. This is also not true. End of quote. I believe that creation care, or earthkeeping, or stewardship, it goes by different names, offers a real opportunity for Christians to relate science and faith in productive and mutually enhancing ways. Perhaps if we stopped arguing about creation and evolution over coffee in church basements and got outside and did some real work caring for our church grounds, our neighborhoods, our cities, we would offer a more winsome witness of our faith. The topic of my presentation, borrowing the theme of this conference for use in my subtitle, is how we can glorify God and serve humanity by caring for the earth. Here's my outline. Three main parts. First, I will remind us, I hope, I will try, of the biblical vision that we humans are earthkeepers, called to serve and protect the earth. Earthkeeping, I argue, is integral to Christian faith. Second, I will argue that we can be good earthkeepers only if we know how the world works, insofar as that's possible. A lot of things we don't know, obviously. We'll never know. But we need to know something, a modicum of knowledge about how the world works. We can properly exercise our biblical calling only if we are ecologically literate. Third, I will illustrate two ways, two only of many, two ways in which science and faith are synergistic. That is, two ways that enhance each other with respect to our calling to be earthkeepers. So, earthkeeping integral to Christian faith, part one. I'll give you a second to read that. The ocean wind smelled of salt and just about blew my hat off. Our eyes were keenly focused on the water. And then we spied them. A pod of pilot whales swimming so effortlessly, a mere 20 yards off the starboard bow. The we there is my wife, Selene, and our three daughters, Anna, Cara, and Sophia, when they were 13, 10, and 8, off the coast of Nova Scotia on a family vacation.
creatures they were. Graceful, playful, winsome.
Another image. I plopped down in the canoe, this time in the boundary waters of northern Minnesota, Quetico Provincial Park, far western Ontario, and rinsed my muddy feet off with lake water. Most of the mud from the mucky portage, or portage, depending on your accent, came off. But one patch between my toes did not. Slowly I realized that the mud, quote unquote, was a rather large, you guessed, leech. With some force, I gently pulled the creature from my toes and placed him on my canoe paddle for my daughters to see. And we talked about leeches and their place in the cycle and scheme of things. All creatures, great and small, God creates them all. So Scripture teaches. The pilot whales and the leeches, the monsters of the deep and the minnows of the shallows, the sparrows and the swallows, the warblers and the waxwings and the woodpeckers. God sees them and says they're good. Again, give you a few seconds to read. We're familiar with the text that speaks of God blessing humans and calling them to be fruitful and multiply, Genesis 1:28. But we often, I think, forget that God also blesses our non-human neighbors, in this case, the aquatic and avian creatures. On the second day of the Genesis 1 creation story, God creates habitats for water and air creatures. And on the fifth day, God creates inhabitants to dwell in those habitats. You, I hope, have noticed how the creation 1 Genesis story comes with two panels, days 1 through 3 on one side, and 4 through 6 on the other, and 4 is correlated to 1, 5 to 2, 6 to 3, and it all leads up, of course, to day 7, 7 being the biblical number of perfection. Habitats and inhabitants, that's what's going on in Genesis 1. And God spreads his blanket of blessing upon these creatures, shrimp and suckers, kites and kingfishers, and commands that they be fruitful. We humans are not the only creatures that God desires to multiply and fill the earth. The earth is home, not just for us. It's also home for sea creatures and land animals, creeping things down low and winged birds up high. We must share our home planet with these our non-human neighbors. God saw the humans he had made and declared they were very good, right? Well, true enough, but it wasn't only humans. This passage is quite clear. God saw everything he had made and said, Tov meod! It's really, really good. Best we start learning Hebrew now because that's what we'll be speaking in heaven, right? Tov meod! Here in the first chapter of the Bible, we read that the work of God's hands is good, indeed very good, a ringing judgment that suggests beauty and peace, as well as what we today think of as goodness. And this includes everything. Marmots and muskrats and mountain lions, goldfinches and barred owls and chickadee-dee-dees. Chickadee-dee-dee. Did you hear them this morning? Pee-wee, chickadee-dee-dee. Butterflies and cicadas, heard them, burying beetles. All these and so many more are included within God's Tov Meod, very good. All right, quiz time again. What does it say on the side of the police car where you live? Serve and protect. And what town is that? Who said serve and protect? Chicago. Other towns? Wisconsin. Wheaton. Serve and protect. All right. On every Chicago police car, it says to serve and protect. I lived in the city of Chicago for 7 years, Hyde Park for 4, 3, North Park for 4. In a city whose motto is, I learned this within the first month of living in the city of Chicago, whose motto is, vote early, vote often. Where even the dead vote more than once. I'm not making this up, that's what I was taught as a resident within the city of Chicago. I smiled every time I saw a police cruiser sporting the English translation of the last part of Genesis 2:15. God placed us in the garden to avad and shamar, to serve and protect. That's our job. To serve and protect the garden that is the earth. Our calling is to be creation's cops, serving and protecting this place so that it and we may flourish. Our God-given vocation is to bring about shalom on this, our earthly home, to foster the flourishing of all things. Made in God's image and from the dust of the earth, that's where we get our name in Hebrew, Adam from the Adama. There's a pun in the Hebrew that we miss in English translation. Humans from the humus, the Latin works, the Hebrew works. Adam from the Adama, humans from the humus. Made in God's image and from the dust of the earth, we human earth creatures are called to represent God and rule as God rules, with justice and righteousness. In short, to serve and protect. In this passage, it's clear that God remembers Noah and his human kinfolk, but God also remembers the animals, wild and domestic, with Noah in that floating species preserve of an ark. The First Endangered Species Act, right? Noah's Ark. God's remembrance includes more than humans. We should not be surprised, since in Genesis 6:18 through 22, the text tells us that God commanded Noah to take two of every species of every living thing into the ark, male and female, with adequate food not only for the humans, but also for the non-human passengers. The Bible tells us again and again that God remembers. It's one of the most important Hebrew words in the Old Testament. Because of God's steadfast love, God's chesed, God's memory is long and sure and true. God remembers us and all of our non-human kin. Furthermore, we're told that the bow in the clouds, this verse, is a sign of the covenant between God and the earth, ha'eretz, the earth. God and the earth, like a steady drumbeat, 8 times in 10 verses, chapter 9, verses 8 through 17. Scripture tells us that God's covenant is with more than humans. Indeed, it's with the earth itself. We tend to think that God is interested only in us humans. Well, God is, of course, interested in us, but the Bible tells us otherwise. And while we take comfort in seeing the rainbow, this passage tells us that it serves as a reminder, notice, primarily, to God. As Frederick Buechner, contemporary novelist, puts it, the rainbow is like a string tied around God's pinky, lest God forget this everlasting covenant. God sees the rainbow and remembers his covenant with creation. I suspect you haven't read this text in a while. This text, tucked into an obscure part of the case law of the Torah, illustrates the principle for living wisely and well. If hungry, you may take the young or the eggs from the bird's nest, but leave the mother. In other words, you may take the fruit, but leave the fruitfulness. Live sustainably. Currently in our world, we are not living sustainably. I gather you've heard some about that in recent days. Our present way of life in North America is like taking the mother along with the fledglings and the eggs. If everyone on Earth lived like us, a number of scientists at the University of British Columbia have written, we would need 3 planets, us meaning us North Americans. We have only 1 planet. So this pattern of overconsumption cannot last. It will not last. What would it look like to take this obscure text seriously? How could we live more in step with God's advice for living well? I could have chosen many psalms. Many are what biblical scholars call nature psalms, but this is one of my favorites. Can sea monsters and cedars, snakes and sandpipers give praise to God? Can trees and rivers clap their hands in praise to God? Is this talk of non-human creatures praising God just a figure of speech, something many people in my guild think it is? It's just a figure of speech. It's personification. This isn't really going on. Is this just an example of a psalmist getting carried away? This joyous psalm is an invitation calling on all creatures in heaven and on earth to praise, offer praise to God, the Creator and Redeemer. Angels and shining stars, mountains and fruit trees, humans young and old, notice, young and old, female and male, rich and poor. All creatures are called upon to sing praise to God. This creational doxology is not commanded, notice. Praise is simply fitting for beings created and redeemed by a loving God. So, says the psalmist, let's sing, each of us in our own creaturely way. Let's join in the hymn of praise. I've been away the last 2 weeks in the Adirondacks. I haven't seen the New York Times in a while, but I caught a glimpse of one the other day, and the front page hasn't changed much in 2 weeks. The daily newspapers give sad testimony to the onslaught of distress we bear. War, famine, poverty, hunger, homelessness, to name just a few. We yearn, do we not, for a time when things will be radically different, when life will be good, right and whole. The prophet, too, yearns for that bright future, a time when delight abounds and the sounds of weeping will be heard no more, a time when infants grow to old age and the aged grow old with grace, a time when those who build houses inhabit them and those who plant vineyards eat their fruit. We long, all of us, I dare say, we long, in short, for shalom, perhaps the most important word in the Old Testament, the flourishing of all things, the coming together of God and us and our non-human neighbors in a rich tapestry of delight, a world no longer bent or broken or out of kilter. In Jesus, we Christians acknowledge that this good future is broken into the not-so-good present, and we acknowledge that we are called to follow this Jesus who made this good future real in his life, who brought a bit of heaven to earth. This salvation, as Isaiah describes it, includes, notice, all manner of things earthy and earthly, the redemption of all things broken and bent. Salvation, both Isaiah and Jesus remind us, is not about our souls going to heaven, but about God's shalom coming to us on earth. In the doxology, we sing, praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, notice, all creatures here below. In the Apostles' Creed, we pledge allegiance to God, the Maker of heaven and earth. In the Lord's Prayer, we pray that God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Our faith, if we take these common songs, creeds, confessions seriously, is earthy and earthly. God's will be done here on earth, in our homes, our schools, our workplaces. God's will be done today, right now, at this time. We pray and work for that day when shalom will be fully realized in this present world. Christian faith is not about going to heaven, but about heaven coming to earth. It's about God's will fully realized. That's what heaven is, right? God's will fully realized here on earth. Creation is groaning, says the Apostle Paul, like a laboring mother giving birth. His images here are very powerful. Creation has been subjected to futility, not of its own will, but because of human sin. So the world God made is not able to achieve its potential. The goals for creation remain unrealized. But creation also waits with eager longing. Like a child on tiptoes early Christmas morning, peeking through the living room door keyhole to see what lies under the Christmas tree. With great anticipation, creation waits with bated breath for us humans to get our act together, our divine image-bearing act together, and be who God calls us to be, creatures called to serve and protect. While we are currently alienated from the natural world, in redemption our relationship, says Paul, with the earth is being restored. This famous text, probably a hymn, most certainly a poem. Very careful if you read this in the Greek, every strophe, every line. The Apostle Paul tells us that God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves, bring about reconciliation. In Christ, God reconciles all things to himself. Tapanta is the Greek word here, all things. Reconciles all things. So redemption does not mean the annihilation of creation, but rather its renewal. Salvation is not escape from the earth, but its reclamation. God is the great recycler, would be a good hymn title if you're preaching on this text. But this peacemaking reconciliation, notice, is bloody. It cost the Messiah his life on a torturous cross. Only in such a way, by nonviolently taking on the taint of sin and absorbing the power of evil, could relationships be restored with God, with other people, with our true best selves, and with the earth. Cosmic reconciliation, the restoration of creation, all things renewed. In probably the earliest book written in the New Testament, Paul's first letter to the church at Thessalonica, he writes about this issue of its second coming. The wedding guests rushed out to meet the bridegroom to join his bridal party as he entered the wedding hall. Another text from the New Testament. The Christians in Rome journeyed 43 miles to meet Paul and become part of his entourage as he entered the capital city. This text in 1 Thessalonians 4, as with those texts I just read, or summarized, Matthew 25, 6 and Acts 28, 15, this text is about going to meet a visiting dignitary in order to escort him back to where you are. This passage does not describe the rapture, as some believe, believers being whisked off the earth. It describes rather just the opposite, the celebratory parade to earth of Christ the King and his followers. This text proclaims the joyous coming of Christ to the earth and the ecstatic response of his followers. Christ is coming, says Paul. And those believers who are alive on that day will be caught up with the dead to meet Christ in the air, so they all might be part of Christ's glorious parade to earth. Paul's picture here is not about escaping from the earth. His vision is rather about greeting the coming king as he returns to establish shalom on earth. The Christian view of the future, eschatology is the fancy word for that. Christian view of the future is earthy and earthly. A couple more. This text, I suspect you haven't read for a while, like that obscure text in Deuteronomy. This time it's Peter, not Paul. Scoffers ridicule the hope of Christ's second coming. This text replies that God is not slow, but patiently forbearing, not wanting any to perish. The day of the Lord will come, very clear in the Greek, emphasis, will come, but it will come like a kleptos, a thief, when nobody expects it. And on that day, after a purifying fire, this is the last clause, the earth and all the works done on it will be disclosed. Purithesetai is the Greek. Californians, it's your state motto. Eureka, I found it. Well, this is future passive. The earth and all the things done on it will be found. You won't find that translation in any English Bible, because this is the most egregious mistranslation in the New Testament, in my view. But will be disclosed. That's what the Greek text says. The heavens and the earth will not be destroyed. They won't be burned up to nothing. That's other English translations, a couple of them. They will rather be found by God, pure like glistening silver, cleansed by fire of all its impurities. The Greek verb in the last clause of verse 10, God indicates God's grand Eureka, I found it, will resound throughout the cosmos. The Christian view of the future, you see, is earth-affirming. God will not destroy what he so lovingly makes, faithfully sustains, and patiently redeems. God's good future is earthy. In keeping with the great vision of Isaiah 65, it includes a renewed heaven and earth. Having brought this world of wonders into existence, covenanted with it, and persistently worked to redeem it, that's the whole biblical story up until now, right? God does not give up on it. God doesn't junk the cosmos and start all over. God renews the old and brings it to fulfillment. Note, God does not make all new things, but all things new. There's a world of difference, pun intended, in those two readings. God makes all things new, not all new things. Continuing here with the second to last chapter of the last book of the New Testament. In God's good future, the separation between heaven and earth is overcome. The now distinct realms are in the future braided together, and they're co-joined because of God's initiative. The holy city, notice, comes down. We don't go up. It comes down from heaven. Its arrival is no human achievement. Its reality, no product of human ingenuity. In keeping with God's character, God comes to us. As in the parable of the running father, Luke 15, maybe you know it as the parable of the prodigal son, but it's not about the prodigal, it's the parable of the running father. As in that parable here in Revelation, John the seer's vision of things, of the future, God initiates redemption. Heaven comes to them, to us. It's literally heaven on earth. In God's good future, evil and its consequences are no more. Seven elements, the biblical number of perfection. Seven elements in this text of the old order are no more. First, the sea, symbolic of primeval chaos and the abode of the beast, mentioned earlier in the book of the Apocalypse, is no more. Second, death itself, not just untimely death, is no more. I need some help from you biologists to try to figure out how that's possible. Mourning and crying and pain are no more. So no more death squad murders in the dark of night. No more mothers and fathers grieving their kids killed in Afghanistan or Iraq or anywhere else in the world. No more stillbirths. Sorry, no more cancer. I just learned the other day of a colleague who was diagnosed 2 weeks ago with cancer and died. Yesterday was the funeral. And all that's under God's curse is no more. The curse of Genesis 3 is repealed. In the words of the old Christian hymn, redemption extends far as the curse is found. And seventh and lastly, night is no more. The realm of darkness and deception is banished. This apocalyptic vision vividly portrays, here's that word again, a world of shalom. In God's good future, we inhabit, I hope you notice when you read this, a most unusual city. Unlike any cities I've ever lived in, Toronto, Los Angeles, Chicago, three of the four largest cities in North America, none of them resemble this city. Notice there's no temple, no set-apart place, for God Himself is the temple. A person has replaced a building. Thus, nothing is profane, nothing not sacred. Everything in this city is for the service of God. And this city is a gardened city. In this city flows the crystalline river of life, watering trees that line its banks. And these trees provide fruit, notice, year-round. There's always something to eat. Sustenance in every season. And the leaves of these trees, notice, are for a healing balm for the nations. Instead of using trees to lay siege to medieval castles or for sailing masts for colonial slave ships, or think of all the other evil uses to which trees have been put in human history. These trees are used for healing. And people of all kinds, the Greek here is ta ethne, all ethnic groups, black, white, brown, yellow, purple, green, everything. All kinds of people stream into this unusual city. Notice whose gates never close, whose light never ceases. Kings and paupers, friends and enemies, they all bring their glory and honor into the city. Nothing from the old order that has value in the sight of God is debarred from entry into this city. This is no world-denying nirvana, but the seal of affirmation on the goodness of God's creation. The treasure that we find laid up in heaven turns out to be the wealth of nations, the best we've known and loved on earth, but redeemed of all of its imperfections and transfigured by God. In short, we find here in the last two chapters of the Apocalypse a stunning picture of shalom. These words of prophetic ecological theologian Joseph Sittler provide, I think, a fitting conclusion to this brief survey of some biblical narrative texts. Joe writes, "When we turn the attention of the church to a definition of the Christian relationship with the natural world, we are not stepping away from grave and proper theological ideas. We are stepping right into the middle of them. There is a deeply rooted, genuinely Christian motivation for attention to God's creation, despite the fact that many church people consider ecology to be a secular concern." All right, back to the outline. Second section, ecological literacy. What do I mean? Well, I borrow from David Orr, a colleague at Oberlin College in Ohio, in his book, now 20 years old, Ecological Literacy. Here's his rough and ready definition. The ecologically literate person has the knowledge necessary to comprehend interrelatedness and an attitude of care or stewardship. And this must be accompanied, thirdly, by the practical competence required to act on the basis of knowledge and feeling. So three parts, three components. Knowing, caring, and practical competence constitute the basis of what he calls ecological literacy. Here are some components. First, broad understanding, I'm quoting Orr again, of how people and societies relate to each other and to natural systems and how they might do so sustainably. This, in my view, presumes knowledge of how the world as a physical system works. So knowledge of things like keystone species and succession, entropy and energy flow, niches and food chains. Ecological literacy, in short, implies a modicum of knowledge about the inextricable interconnectedness of all creatures, great and small. Second component, quoting Orr again, knowledge of the speed of the crisis that is upon us. We need to know the vital signs of our home planet, things like trends concerning population growth and climate change. You had a talk on climate change, I'm told, just yesterday. Soil loss and species extinction, deforestation and desertification, energy use and air pollution. A prescription is only as good as the diagnosis on which it's based, whether it's you seeing your family doctor or us together talking about the earth. Our attempts, individual and collective, to achieve wellness must be based on a sober assessment of the health of the earth. In one of my books, the updated version of For the Beauty of the Earth, Chapter 2 is an attempt to do exactly this, to kind of take the vital signs of the planet. It's not all bad news, by the way. I was just in the Adirondacks. You know what? Acid rain has decreased in the Adirondacks in the last 20 years, largely because of the renewal of the Clean Water and Clean Air Act of 1990. And the air in Los Angeles is cleaner now than when my wife and I lived there 25 years ago. And some species have come back from extinction, or near extinction, I should say. It's not all bad news. But really sobering facts when it comes to the health of our planet. I won't go into those now. We can talk about that a bit maybe during question and answer time. Some of you, I'm sure, are much more expert at that than I am. But a prescription is only as good as the diagnosis on which it's based. We need to have a sober assessment of the health in all of its different aspects of our home planet. Third component, comprehension of the dynamics of the modern world. Boy, that covers a lot of ground. In other words, we need some understanding of the historical, political, economic, and religious forces that have molded our world. You could add all kinds of other adjectives in there. And you can see right now, if you take even the first three of these components seriously, you've got a liberal arts education. You need some biology, you need some geology, you need some chemistry, throw in a little physics. You need now some economics, some politics, some history. And don't forget religion. Most of our universities don't have religious studies departments. Many of the long-term people working in our government, being educated at elite Ivy League colleges, have never had a course in religion. And we wonder why we go so off the rails in our foreign policy. We don't know a Sunni from a Shiite. We don't know the different forms of Buddhism. You can't understand the world without knowing something about its religions. And yet many modern people, including positions of political and economic power, know virtually nothing about religion. They don't know much about Christianity or Judaism, for that matter. What would this mean, those of you who are educators, if we took this seriously? We're not there yet at Hope, although we have a liberal arts education, religion courses are required, but I'm pushing for an eco-literacy requirement to go along with all the other stuff that we require of our students. Don't have to major in biology, but again, a certain basic understanding of how the world works. What ideas and social pressures have brought us to where we are today? What key ideas, say in the writings of people like Descartes and Locke in the 16 and 1700s, have resulted in the degradations that we experience today? Fourth, what do we need? Again, quoting Orr, broad familiarity with the development of ecological consciousness. What does he mean by that? Of special importance here, I think, is explicit attention to ethics and the nature of nature. I mean, what is nature? When I taught logic in the philosophy department years ago, on the front page of a syllabus, I had an ancient Chinese proverb: whoever defines the terms wins the argument. You let me define the terms of any hot-button social issue, I guarantee I will win the argument. Language is not neutral. What is it we call the world in which we live that is indeed a part of us? Because each of us right now has oxygen molecules in our lungs that were breathed out by some living green thing. Those crazy photo collectors we call leaves on the deciduous trees surrounding this building, for example. What is the world in which we live? Is it nature? Do you capitalize the N, or is it small case? Is it environment? That sterile term birthed in some, I don't know, some graduate program somewhere, I'm tempted to say. Do we live in an environment? Or is it the earth? Is it creation, which of course implies a creator? E.O. Wilson's book a few years ago, I reviewed it, I think for Science, one of the big journals. Right? The creation, I pointed out in my review. That's an interesting title. Coming from, well, Ed's not an atheist. I met him a couple years ago at a conference. We had actually had a bunch of people had lunch together, and he said, he's an agnostic. And he was a Baptist, grew up Baptist. And he titles his book Creation. That implies a creator, right? Our language is non-neutral. Are we humans, conqueror of the land community? I'm quoting Aldo Leopold now, San County Almanac. Or plain member and citizen of it. Or maybe something else. Maybe neither of those is adequate. Not only how do we view the earth, creation, how do we view ourselves? Are we conquerors? Or are we just another organism, $29.13 worth of carbon and potassium and, you know, basic compounds pulled off the periodic table? Is the natural world red in tooth and claw, as some Darwinians and others would have us believe, or some paradise of harmony, as perhaps the Romanticists like Rousseau would have us believe? Or maybe, again, neither of those is accurate. I'm not here to answer those questions, but simply to say that that's a component of ecological literacy, is watching our language, how we describe ourselves and the world in which we live. Fifth and finally, we need a development of alternative measures of well-being and a different approach to technology. For example, Daley and Cobb's Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare, in contrast to other indicators such as the gross domestic product. This index, developed by a theologian and an economist, includes the depletion of non-renewable natural resources and the costs of water and air pollution in its calculation of overall welfare. The GDP doesn't measure that stuff. It doesn't look at sources and sinks. It just measures basically economic activity. And the work of people, there are many, many, these are just a few of the authors I've read, somewhat familiar with. E.F. Schumacher, more classically from the 60s and 70s, but more recently, Nancy and John Todd, Sam van der Rijn, Stuart Cowan. Their work illustrates how technology can and must be appropriate to the scale and needs of a people and its culture. We, I think, whether you agree or not, we'll see, maybe talk about this in a bit. We are a culture infatuated with technology. I teach a course every May in the Adirondacks, 2 weeks of which were backpacking, whitewater rafting, canoeing, 10 students, 3 other instructors. 4 faculty, 10 students. Everybody goes without their technology, electronic technology, for about 9 days. Students give up their cell phones, their iPods, all that stuff. I've been teaching this course since 1983. It didn't used to be a problem. It is now. It's like fasting. That's basically what I'm asking the students to do. Fast from their electronics for a week and a half. Some of them find it very difficult. Many of them report after the experience is over how liberating it was, how freeing. Not to always be flipping their cell phones every 90 seconds, checking their Facebook page or whatever. Alternative measures of well-being and a different approach to technology. That's one part of ecological literacy. Let me talk briefly about another. Some basic learnings from ecology and natural science more generally. Speaking as someone who is really an outsider, my undergraduate degree was in math and computer science, but my graduate degrees are all in humanities and social sciences. So, but this, it seems to me, is important if we think as Christians about caring for the earth. What do we need to know from the natural sciences and the science of ecology in particular? Well, the first is what I call a principle of interrelatedness. Everything is hitched to everything else. I borrowed that metaphor from John Muir in his great book, My First Summer in the Sierra. All things are interconnected. Everyone is downwind or downstream of everyone else. So the golden rule of canoeists, do you know this one? Treat those downstream as you would have those upstream treat you. Because we all live downstream and upstream, right? The acid rain in the Adirondacks doesn't come from New York State. It comes from my home state, Michigan, and Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and the prevailing westerly winds. They haven't yet learned how to read state lines or international borders, right? They blow it 650 miles to the east and it falls. Is acid rain and snow and sleet and everything else in the Adirondacks. We all live downwind and downstream and upstream and upwind. Everything is hitched to everything else. Second, and an implication really of the first, we can never do only one thing. Our actions always have consequences, some of which we do not know and cannot predict. What I call the principle of multiple effects. I switch on a light in the classroom in the basement of the chapel where we have classrooms on my campus, and I draw electricity from a coal-burning power plant about 3/4 mile away, which produces sulfur dioxide, which then falls as sulfuric acid in my beloved Adirondacks. You cannot do only one thing. A few more. There is no away. We say we throw things away. I take a garbage can in front of my class and I say, where's away? Where's this stuff going? It doesn't just disappear. Right? Chemists, physicists, basic laws of thermodynamics here, right? Everything goes somewhere. We cannot create or destroy matter. Matter merely changes form. Principle of matter conservation. Where's your local away? 90% of my students don't know where that place is. They don't know where their water comes from or where their waste goes. And in a number of classes I teach, that's one of my goals, is to help them learn where away is. Fourth, we cannot get something from nothing. It takes energy to get energy. You cannot create or destroy energy. You can only change it from one form to another. And in energy conversion, entropy or disorder increases, what I call the principle of energy conversion, as distinct from matter conservation. Fifth, everything fills a niche. Every organism has a function within a habitat. Every species adaptively fits a role in an ecosystem. Principle of fittingness. Sixth, things change. We live in an incredibly dynamic universe. The Earth's living organisms and natural cycles are constantly changing. Principle of dynamic systems. Incredibly dynamic. So much so that, at least the science I read, we haven't figured it out. We probably never will. Too complex. Complexity theory, chaos theory, all those things. Incredibly dynamic universe. Seven, you adapt or die. Individual organisms, populations, and species either adapt to their surroundings or cease to exist. The principle of adaptation. My friend Kent, who runs a church camp in the Adirondacks, I was just there yesterday morning, there for 2 weeks, volunteering. A couple of my kids work there. Is now planting different kinds of trees in the south central Adirondacks because of climate change. He wants those trees to last, and He doesn't want to plant trees that 60 or 100 years from now, with the climate much warmer, won't flourish. So he's borrowing trees from lower latitudes and planting them in the middle of the Adirondacks. 8, the earth swims in diversity. There's genetic diversity within a given species, diversity of individual species of organisms, and diversity of different kinds of natural systems, different kinds of diversity. There's diversity of diversity, in other words, the principle of diversity. 9, there's not always more, except for the energy income from the sun, our star. The world is finite. We live in a world of limits. We live in a world of limits. 10th and finally, the natural world is more complex than we think. Indeed, it's more complex than we can ever possibly imagine. Both of these, you, I'm sure, can infer, promote an important virtue, namely humility. Right? That's not a Greco-Roman virtue, by the way. Neither Plato or Aristotle mentioned virtue. In fact, it's a vice for them. But for Jesus, for St. Paul, for Augustine, for Aquinas, for virtually every major Christian thinker, it's one of the important virtues. If there's not always more, and the world is more complex than we can ever possibly imagine, then we ought to be humble and circumspect in what we claim to know and what we do. It's not enough for us to heed the call to serve and protect. We Christian earthkeepers need to know how the world works. Back to the outline. Roman numeral 3, some examples of science, faith, synergy. A brief word about synergy. There are two related but somewhat different concepts of synergy. One common understanding of synergy is something like this: the total effect is greater than the sum of the individual effects. For example, we sometimes speak of the dangerous synergistic effects of drugs. A second understanding of synergy has to do with the claim that something enhances the effectiveness of something else. For example, a reagent in a chemical reaction. Synergy is from the Greek, it's synergos, two Greek words, and means simply working together. I take it that the crux of the meaning is that synergy refers to the enhancement of something by something else. So science, faith, synergy, to be specific, refers to how natural science and Christian faith can enhance each other, augment, improve, strengthen each other. Let me talk about one example, or set of examples. In his award-winning book, Until Justice and Peace Embrace, Christian philosopher Nicholas Wolterstorff develops the concept of governing interest. A governing interest is that personal conviction or collective set of beliefs that shapes the direction in which a scholar turns his or her inquiry. In other words, a governing interest determines one's research agenda or research program. It governs what scholars decide to study or investigate, what they choose to think about, do research about, write about. Nick goes on to argue that Christian scholars ought to engage in praxis-oriented theorizing, or the scholarship of social commitment. In other words, they ought to choose to direct their research in ways that will make the world a better place. In Christian terms, they ought to direct their scholarly endeavors in the service of shalom. I quote from Nick's book. My plea is for the integration of social commitment and theorizing, more specifically for the integration of Christian commitment and theorizing, by way of the commitment becoming the governing interest of the theorizing. It is indeed possible for scholars to adopt as the governing interest of their inquiries the making of a contribution to the formation of a body of nominological theory, which for him means a unified body of laws that provides an ever more complete explanation of some aspect of our world. Scholars may do so, still quoting Wolterstorff, because someone to whom they owe obedience, such as a doctoral advisor, has told them to do so. Or they may do so because they think that knowledge, this kind of knowledge, is of intrinsic worth for human beings and they wish to share in making this good available to humanity. Or again, they may do so because they see that nominological theory is of use in technology and they wish to contribute to this technological resource. Or they may be entirely free of such altruistic impulses and do simply what they do, simply because they find the prospect of being discoverers in the landscape of natural law delightful, even exciting. Whatever their reasons, still quoting Olderstorff, they can adopt as the governing interest of their inquiries the making of a contribution to the formation of theory. But so too, they can adopt some social goal as their governing interest. And they can in that way integrate commitment and theorizing. End quote. In short, the social goal that Nick recommends, if one is a Christian, is shalom. So Christian scholars, on the basis of their Christian convictions, he argues, ought to pursue a research agenda that will contribute to shalom. This may sound far-fetched, but I can think of actually quite a few colleagues at various places who exemplify this admonition. A colleague in the communication department, where I taught here in Chicago for a while, when in grad school, chose the public discourse on HIV/AIDS as her dissertation research topic. When I asked her why, when I first met her, get to know each other, why she chose that topic for her dissertation research, she said, because of my Catholic Christian faith. Another colleague in the theater department decided to write a play about violence in Central America. When I asked him why that topic of the many he could have chosen, he said, because I'm a Mennonite. When asked why he does research, the research he does, my friend Dave Warner is a botanist in the Calvin College Biology Department, and I see at least one friend from Calvin is here, states that as a Christian, he hopes his research in some measure contributes to God's shalom. When asked the same question about his research agenda, my friend John Peterson, a member of the Geology Department at Hope, where I teach, replies that his research on water remediation is one way that he as a Christian can serve God and make the world a better place. All of these examples, I hope, make this point. Faith can and does motivate scholars, including natural scientists, to seek shalom in the practice of their scholarship. This is but one way we can integrate our Christian commitment in our scholarly research. It's one way faith can enhance science. There are other ways, of course, that faith enhances science. Christian faith provides a larger context of meaning for the practice of science. Christian faith encourages the empirical investigation of the natural world. Christian faith fosters a sense of wonder about the workings of the natural world. Christian faith cultivates a proper sense of humility, given both our finitude and our fallenness. In all these ways, faith enhances science and strengthens our ability to glorify God and serve humanity. But it also works the other direction. Science enhances faith. There are many ways this is true. Let me just focus on one. Science can enhance faith by informing the work of Christian earthkeepers, for example, allowing their work to be more effective. As indicated earlier, we're all called to serve and protect the earth, but we can do so only if we are ecologically literate. One of the clearest examples of sound science enhancing Christian creation care, I think, one of the clearest examples is the Ausable Institute of Environmental Studies. Founded in northern Michigan in the early 1980s under the direction of Cal DeWitt, the Institute has for over three decades trained hundreds of Christian undergraduates in basic environmental science. Whether taking sediment samples on Twin Lake or catching mackerel invertebrates on the Boardman River, whether studying basic botany or learning new molecular tools as a field biologist, whether engaged in stream habitat recovery or involved with the census of endangered bird species, the Ausable Institute has not only taught important skills but also imparted the conviction that good science must undergird the care we Christians desire to give to the natural world and its creatures. A number of you I know in the audience have taught at Ausable over the years and know firsthand of what I speak. Perhaps the example I know best from personal experience of the synergistic effects of science and faith is a collaborative research project I alluded to earlier I had a hand in organizing a few years ago. In 2003, Janelle Curry, a geographer from Calvin College, Mark Bagelland, a geographer from Gustavus Adolphus College, John Wood, a biologist from King's University College in Edmonton, Alberta, Susan Bratton, a biologist and historian from Baylor University, and I, a philosopher and theologian from Hope, organized a summer research seminar at Calvin College. The three-week-long seminar involved the five of us and 15 other scholars, literally from all over the world, from a wide array of different disciplines. The title and topic was Christian Environmentalism with/out Boundaries. A year after the summer seminar, we presented our research, a special day-long symposium at the July 2004 annual meeting of the ASA at Trinity Western University near Vancouver. The papers were subsequently published in Perspectives, March 2005. In addition, the book Living the Good Life on God's Good Earth, with 10 chapters, each authored by a member of the seminar team, was published in 2006. The seminar was not only interesting and stimulating in all kinds of ways, it also vividly illustrated the fact that none of us alone could have done what we were able to do together. Call it synergy or the Gestalt effect. The whole was more than the sum of the individual parts. And to the point of this talk, the seminar was an example of how that aspect of our lived faith called earthkeeping is greatly enhanced when informed by sound science. Botanist David Clements taught us about weeds in the context of a discussion of invasive species. Geographer Mark Bagelin taught us about new urbanism in our discussion of housing. Biologist David Cucci taught us about genetically modified crops in our discussion of contemporary agriculture. Our individual and collective efforts at earthkeeping were more effective and more winsome as a Christian witness of the gospel because they were informed by the best science. Now, there are other ways, of course, that science enhances faith. Natural science provides in-depth ways of understanding the world God created and continues to sustain. Natural science offers insight into the Bible. Natural science supplies tools to alleviate human suffering. In all these ways, science enhances faith and strengthens our ability to glorify God and serve humanity. So faith enhances science, and science enhances faith. More exactly, faith motivates science to seek shalom in the practice of their science, and science informs the work of Christian earthkeepers, allowing their work to be more effective. I'll go back. That's a group of my mater and the Adirondacks. We just baked that cake for dessert, and the dog is sleeping. Conclusion. This young scholar, not Augustine, this young scholar was just out of college and one of the most promising students I'd ever had in a decade of teaching. He first attended Princeton Seminary, then transferred to Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia. He did very well academically at both schools, but was not convinced that theology and our Christian ministry was where God was calling him. So he then enrolled in a master's program in environmental education at the Teton Science School in Moose, Wyoming, in the southeastern part of the Teton National Park. Before he matriculated there, I told Ryan what to expect, namely that he would most likely be the only Christian in his entering class of 25 students, and that many of his classmates will probably think he's the enemy of all things environmental. At Christmas, after his first semester, we talked by phone, and Ryan confirmed that my predictions had come true. He was, as far as he could tell, the only Christian in his class, and all the other students, whatever their religious or non-religious beliefs, thought Christianity was the main reason for much of the ecological degradation in the world. Therefore, Christians were public enemy number one with respect to environmental sustainability. In May, at the end of his first year, we talked again, and he said something I've never forgotten. He'd become close friends with a number of his classmates, and they'd come to know that Ryan was a committed Christian. Indeed, they learned that the major reason he was an earthkeeper and enrolled at the Teton Science School was because of his faith. As the school year was about to end, one of Ryan's friends, an avowed atheist, said to him, "You know, Ryan, if you started a church, I just might come." one example of science-faith synergy, how we can glorify God and serve humanity by caring for the earth. Thank you.
We have time for a question or two.
Speak nice and loud so everyone can hear you.
I myself am a convert to Christianity, and one of the things that brought me around as a born and raised agnostic was the realization when I finally had to confront what Christianity really said, that I had a set of ethical values, but I didn't have a foundation for it, and that the foundation was Jesus Christ.
Great. Thank you very much. That's a very good question, 2 Peter 3. What are the tastoikeia? That's the Greek word for elements there. That word is used only a couple times in the New Testament, and it's rarely used elsewhere. We really don't know what that means. Commentators, if you would take, you know, a dozen commentaries from a seminary library all on 2 Peter, you would find some commentators say it's the periodic table. Others that it's heavenly bodies. You know, what does the elements, that's the usual translation, what does that mean exactly? We just don't know enough to make a firm conclusion on what the elements are. It's very clear, though, that there's a burning. It's a participial form of that verb used there. Burning the elements. And some translations read dissolve, but it's more loosened is the Greek word. Just like you loosen your shoelace. They're loosened up. And I think it's a smelting metaphor. If you go back to some Old Testament images there, that's what's being referred to. Most North American Christians read the fire as a fire of destruction, and really it's a fire of purification, the way that a smelter would purify silver, burning off the impurities. So there's continuity and discontinuity there. Beyond that, it's too difficult to say based on that text. That's where I think you have to go to other texts, like Revelation. Correct. It does not say that. And it's the same with Revelation 21. It says 21:1 opens a new heaven, new earth. The Greek word is kainos, not naos. Naos means neo, where we get the word neo, the prefix, means absolutely brand new. Kainos means renewed, basically. So reclaimed, renewed. I saw a renewed earth. And that fits with the rest of the biblical story, right? So if you look at the whole narrative, it's eschatology goes with protology, right? God creates and God sustains and God redeems and restores, and God will continue to do so. And remember, with eschatology, this is a whole other lecture, but eschatology shapes our ethics. What we think of the future shapes our actions in the present. That's how important it is. What we think of the future, if we think the future means the earth is going to be destroyed, burned up to nothing, as many secular commentators say about Christians, stands to reason they don't care about the earth. They don't believe it's going to be burned up. All the Christians are supposedly going to be whisked off the planet, right? So that's a very strong critique I read a lot in secular environmental literature about Christians. And in one of my tasks and what I research and write on is to say that's a mistaken view of Christianity. I don't know if we have any more time.
Well, thank you. One more time.